Hello everybody and welcome back to another episode of On The Mat BJJ Podcast. Today's guest is Shanti Abelha and she will talk about her experiences with BJJ and competing and a lot of other cool stuff. I really hope you enjoy the podcast, and as usual this podcast is sponsored by Top Rank Equipment and Defense Soap. So check out Top Ranked and Defense Soap on their Facebook pages and web pages. You just have to Google it. Okay guys, are you ready for the podcast? Let's go. Welcome to a new episode of On The Mat BJJ Podcast, and today's guest is Shanti.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're so welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Just got home from a hard day of work and a really nice training, so I'm tired but happy.
Tired but happy, that sounds
yes.
good.
Yes.
So what's going on with you these days?
Well, these days, I didn't really take a break over the summer after Worlds because I was attending and teaching at a lot of summer camps, but I wasn't training. I was training like a lot of hours and a lot of technique, but not sparring and doing as, you know, hard competition training as before.
Okay.
So now here after the summer, I'm slowly feeling that I'm getting into competition shape again. And yeah, and besides that, work is busy as well. So in general, everything's kind of busy right now.
Yeah. As we mentioned before we got started here, we talked about the GTC lifestyle. This is the fabulous lifestyle we talked about.
Exactly. This is it. It's a lot of hard work, especially if you have a full-time career like as I do. Then it's hard to do both at a high level.
Yeah, so. Sure. If you could explain to the listeners a little bit about yourself, who are you? When did you get started with the BJJ?
Well, my name is Shanti Abelha. I'm originally Brazilian, but I moved out of Brazil when I was 4 years old, and I grew up in England and the United States and also here in Denmark, where I've been for over 15 years. So I have a pretty international background.
Yeah.
My Brazilian jiu-jitsu, even though my blood is Brazilian, I usually say that my Brazilian jiu-jitsu is European or is Danish, actually, because that's pretty much where I started. I was doing actually some kung fu, some Wing Chun kung fu at some point because I wanted to learn self-defense.
In Denmark.
Okay. Yes, this was about 10, 11 years ago. And after about a year, and I've always done sports my whole life. I did gymnastics, basketball, football, pretty much everything, capoeira. And then at some point I was like, no, I want to learn some of this self-defense stuff because I was studying and I was often working at bars and things in the evenings and the weekends, going home late, catching the bus late, feeling a little insecure. So I was like, okay, let me learn some of this self-defense stuff. So I got into the Wing Chun Kung Fu, which was fine. In a way, they taught you how to kick and punch and stuff like that. But pretty quickly, I realized we had like a pretty cool girls training there where the coach would put on like full armor, pretty much headgear, pads, body pads, everything. And we could like try out actual sparring or try, you know, to do something
like full contact sparring.
Yeah. Well, no, he wouldn't go that crazy on us. But okay. We could go full contact and he would go like very light.
Yeah.
What I realized really quickly was that usually within about 15, 20 seconds, he would somehow push me down to the ground, and then that was kind of it for me. Then I couldn't really do much, and a lot of the rest of the training and all the scenario-based stuff that Wing Chun did was really based on the stand-up, based on bar fights and things like that. And I was like, hey, I'm a girl. I'm scared of, you know, some man on the way home thinking that it would be really nice if I lay down on the floor, on the ground. And at the same time, then the place I was training at, actually, they got a Brazilian in and started teaching Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So I tried out one or two classes. I wasn't really sure. Then I had half a year in Brazil on an exchange program for skiing, where my cousin was the one who actually pressured me into doing BJJ. He was like, oh, you have to go try this. You have to do this. I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. But so I did 2 months in Nova Union in Rio, actually under André Pedeneiras there. Even trained with UFC champ Jose Aldo at that time, before he was all that known, and went out and saw one of his first MMA fights. So that's funny to think about today. I really didn't like BJJ in the beginning, to be truthful. No, I hated it.
Finally.
I really didn't like it.
Every guest so far has always said, I fell in love with the first in the first training.
I didn't.
You didn't. Okay, so finally you got one. Yeah, okay.
No, there was no love about like being under side control, bottom side control, you know, under some heavy, sweaty person. So no, I didn't really like it in the beginning, but I'm pretty stubborn. I have a really stubborn mindset, and I decided, you know, I'd read up on it and I could see that this would be some good self-defense to know. So I decided, no, I'm going to stick this out at least for a while, at least that I feel comfortable, you know, defending myself, doing something on the ground. So I stuck with it. Also, when I came back from the exchange program, and after a while, I actually started liking it. I think also partially because when I'd been younger, you know, I'd done a lot of sports and I'd competed a lot, and then I'd been away from competitions. And all of a sudden, I could see possibility of competing and having fun in that way and being together with teammates and stuff like that in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So, yeah, then I kind of stuck with it.
For how long did you do the Kung Fu thing?
Well, I did the Kung Fu thing for a total of a year and a half or 2 years.
Yeah, okay.
But actually, as soon as I came back from Brazil, from the exchange program, I dropped the Kung Fu thing pretty fast.
Yeah, okay.
And and stuck to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
And you were in Brazil for how long training?
I trained BJJ there for maybe 2 or 3 months, I think.
Yeah.
And even competed there for the first time ever. Didn't know what I was doing, but
How did it go?
I didn't get tapped, but I lost on points, like 16-0. But it was a fun experience.
Yeah.
It was fun to try. So so that was the start.
Yeah, when you started training, was it like more into self defense, or is it like today almost like a sport jiu-jitsu?
No, everything, my training has always been sports jiu-jitsu training in that way. I've never trained the traditional Gracie self defense system at all. All the places I've trained, whether it's been Brazil or Denmark or anywhere, has always been with a focus on competition. BJJ and modern BJJ as we know it.
Yeah, okay.
So I have no background in the actual self-defense part of it, but I think what I have hopefully fulfills fulfills the thoughts and the needs that I had 10 years ago. So, okay. Yeah.
So what keeps you motivated these days?
That's a really good question. I think there's several things right now. I'm 32 years old. So on the one hand, I feel that my competition days are coming to an end at some point. I've been saying that for the last 3 years, but I do feel that it's taking its toll on the body. I do feel that my energy and at some point my priorities will change. I've always had, you know, high demands at work as well and everything.
Yeah.
And at some point you just kind of run out of energy to run after everything at the same time. But for now, as long as I still feel that I'm having fun competing and that I'm improving competing and that it's worth it, then I'll keep doing that. So my motivation comes that I still think it's fun to compete and still think it's fun to win. And if you want to compete and you want to win, you need to train hard.
Yeah.
pretty much it. Besides that, slowly teaching a little bit more. I teach regularly now at the gym once a week, and I, you know, try besides that kind of on the side once in a while to, you know, help the up and coming people with their game, with the aspect of what does it take to compete at a high level, what do you have to think about and things like that.
Yeah.
And it keeps me motivated that we have such a high level at the academy that, you know, I can't just take a break. If I take a break, then it's bad enough as it is now that, you know, one day you're doing fine against, you know, the new young 17, 18 year old blue belts. All of a sudden, half a year later, they're like kicking your butt, which is really cool because, you know, that just proves that we have a great gym.
Yeah.
But that's also, it helps, it motivates me because I can never just think, oh, I'm good enough as I am. You know, there's always room for improvement.
Yeah.
In BJJ. There'll always be room for improvement no matter what level you're at. And when you're reminded of that daily, you know, that pushes me. And when I want to teach, I want to feel that I can give something of value when I'm teaching, that I can pass on some knowledge. And for that, I have to develop myself as well.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I won't have anything to pass on in that way, or nothing new and stuff like that. So yeah, my motivation still comes from competing, but comes also in general just from I always want to do better. I'm the kind of person who always likes to improve, always likes to learn new things.
Yeah.
And that's why BJJ is so awesome, because you can never stop getting better.
Exactly. Is the teaching part something you like to be doing more of?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. I really enjoy teaching. It started out slowly with the girls classes for a period that we had, and you know, I teach seminars, girls seminars, but also mixed seminars. I've taught both in Europe and the United States, and a bit in Brazil. And I like teaching. I think it's fun. I think it's fun to help other people develop as well.
Yeah.
I think I've considered, you know, I did have considered several times whether I should become a, what's it called, like a full-time ninja, as we say.
Yeah.
And of course, not only to, that would mean I would have more time for my own training and competing and so on, but of course also teaching. But right now the situation in most places is that's not a viable means of making a living.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's too hard, and I do enjoy the other aspects of that I have at my normal job right now in my normal career.
Yeah.
I like that as well. You know, I need a kind of a varied everyday life. So yeah, but I certainly imagine that the less I compete, the more I will do something, like the more I will get into the teaching part.
Do you still feel like you have goals that you want to fulfill that hasn't been completed yet?
Yeah, I do. I still want that gold at Black Belt Worlds.
Yeah. At the adult or which?
Adult.
Yeah.
Adult.
So you perhaps give it another try next year?
Yeah, I had big doubts. Well, I've had doubts every year the last couple of years about it. And no, and this year I really did think, I was like, okay, now this is my third time. Not third time. Fifth time with a bronze medal at the highest level at Worlds. I'm like, okay, maybe I should just say that was it and go on to Masters. And I was like, so I actually had a good talk over the summer with Leo Vieira, who's a head coach for Checkmate, about it. And, you know, I have, he's always honest in the things he said. So I asked him, actually, I said, look, do you think I should start transitioning to Masters? Or, you know, what do you see? And he said, yeah, and he told me, well, if you want to do Masters, of course you can do. And, you know, for the smaller competitions or you know, where there are Masters, you know, you can do that. So you don't always have to be prepared for adult. But he said, I still see that you have potential to do really well in adult. So I don't think you should change out of adult Worlds yet, but still have that as your main goal for the year.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay. Here we go again, 2015.
Yeah.
One more time, let's try it and see.
when you look back at the competitions, did you see like the main thing that you need to like be better at to be able to get the gold? Is it something specific that you can see?
Yeah, I do, and I've seen that for the last couple of years, and I'm still not I'm still haven't been able to do what it takes. But for me, I'm not all that great at the strategy part.
Okay.
of competition. The funny thing is, I've been good when I've taught it to others. I can tell other people, okay, against that and that opponent, you should go in, do this, have this game plan, do, you know, your top game for 4 minutes, do you, you know, do guard for 4 minutes, then sweep, then do blah, blah, blah. I can like make that plan for other people. For myself, I'm really bad at it. I just go in and I spar.
Okay.
Which of course, if you are And in a way, if I was really good enough, that wouldn't matter. You could say, you know, okay, if you're really better than everyone else, it doesn't matter what strategy you have, you're just better. But the reality is, at black belt, everyone's really good. So a lot of the margins, you know, a lot of what people win on is the strategy part. Is, you know, avoiding the other person's A game, or, you know, having a different kind of A game or than what the other person expect, or, you know, something else. And that part, I feel that yeah, that part I don't do very well. So that's definitely what I'll be looking at to improve for next year.
Is
And
the point game for you like kind of boring for you, or is it like you just go guns blazing or?
it's more the guns blazing also, because we do a lot of I you know, when I step on the mat to fight, I try to get my mindset as if it was a good training.
Okay.
But at training we do, you know, a lot of not 10 minutes round, maybe a lot of 6 minutes round. So in my body, I'm kind of used to the 6 minutes. So what I've noticed, especially this year, where actually I had a good year in terms of I fought technically well, and I don't, you know, I'm a referee as well, so I know the point systems, I know when to get advantages and everything like that. But my problem is, you know, I do kind of everything I want to do within like 6 or 7 minutes, and then I look at the watch and I think, crap, now I have three or
There's
four
still more
minutes left.
time
There's
left.
still more time. What am I
God damn
supposed to
it.
do?
Yeah.
And then in the time where I'm thinking, what am I supposed to do? You know, stuff happens and I lose, or I don't, or I lost. Yeah. The whole strategy thing, it's not that I, it's not about, you know, oh, that I think the points game is boring. I just need a better plan
Okay.
and to go in and execute it. So that's my main thing right now. Besides that, of course, there's, you know, working on my weaknesses. Everyone has weaknesses, and I want to be an all round. I don't want to be, you know, a black belt world champion with a great A game, but no B game, you know, just a
Okay,
C and a D
yeah.
game. I don't want to have like one part of my game where you think, oh wow, she's really black belt in that, but if you put her in another position, you know, she's blue belt.
You want to
I
be
want to
like
be
more complete.
good. I want to be good, complete player. That's important for me as well. So I'm always trying to work on my weaknesses, fix the holes I can fix. And then there's the whole, for me, I think there's also the whole mental aspect of it, which I've gotten better at the last few years as well. But in the beginning, when I moved up from purple belt, I moved to brown, and brown and black were still together.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I went from, you know, fighting other purple belts who weren't full-time Brazilian jiu-jitsu players to fighting world-class black belt champions who do this for a living. And it kind of takes a mental hurdle to convince yourself that, okay, even though I'm not training even half of what they train, because I'm not, I know how much they train, even though I'm not training half of what they train, I can still win.
Yeah.
That's a hard one to get in my own to get in
Yeah,
my own head, you
I can
know?
see
Because I'm like, hey, if I was training twice as much as
that.
this, I sure wouldn't lose to someone who wasn't training that hard, you
Exactly.
know? So, yeah.
So, is there any person like game-wise that you can look up to or get inspiration from?
Oh, I'm not the big, not that much. I mean, of course, I look a little bit at what people do. Girls' games are also a little different than the men, even though the positions are the same, the way they, you know, kind of do things and put things together, and the tempo, the pace is different. I mean, I really like Michelle Nicolini, her style in terms of that. Firstly, she's kept, you know, she's been on top of the world and always winning for a really long time now, and she has a really awesome aggressive game. But there's a lot of, you know, a lot of other athletes out there, both my fault, even some of the ones I've lost a lot to, who I think are really good, and some of the up and coming. But I don't spend that much time like on YouTube looking, oh, I want to do that move from her, or, you know, oh, I want to do Keenan's worm guard or something like that. And that's, for me, it's a question of priorities. You know, I work the whole day, so, and then I train in the evening. So the whole, when am I going to sit and watch YouTube? No, my jujitsu is what I learn on the mats,
Okay.
and then
So
I apply
who do you
that.
who do you trust in to keep you like updated so you don't get surprised by new stuff?
Don't believe that much in getting surprised by new stuff if you
Okay.
have if you have good if you have a good base.
Okay.
I believe in always developing yourself in terms of doing also new things, and of course times change and trends and okay, you know, a few years ago people did a lot of half guard. Now De La Riva is like back in fashion
Yeah.
and things like that. So you always have to kind of keep up. And the way I do that is especially through especially because we have a lot of people from outside who come and give seminars. Leo Vieira always comes once or twice a year. And we have some of the other top Checkmate people as well. And especially, I can always trust Leo to every time he comes to turn something around. You know, one he'll say, okay, now this we're passing the guard like this. The next year is like, okay, forget what I said last year. Now we're doing this instead. So he always has a different way of. I think he's one of the people who actually are most innovative within BJJ, because things like Worm Guard and some of the more modern stuff, it's in a way it's still the old stuff, but in another kind of way. Leo sometimes comes up with things where I'm like, okay, that is opposite, completely the opposite of what we're doing, or completely the opposite of what people would expect you to do in that situation or something. So that's really cool. And that's how I keep updated, is through him and through whatever Shimon also shows. And we just generally have really good high quality teaching at the gym. And in terms of being surprised, I've never been surprised at a tournament about something new. If your base is good, you know, you're not going to get swept by something new. If you get swept, it's because your base is crap and you don't have, you know, good balance. And you let the other person control you. If you don't let them get the control to start with, it doesn't matter if it's Worm Guard or whatever else. You're not going to get De La Riva, Benimboru. You're not going to get swept. So for me, it's about that. It's about having your basic jiu-jitsu, having that as good as possible, because from that you're going to be able to defend a lot of positions. And then of course you always have to develop your own attacking game.
So it's all
So
about the base.
always all about the base. And I mean, the new stuff, we have people at the gym who try a lot of the new stuff. We have people who, you know, who spend a little more time than I do on watching instructionals and watching things on YouTube. So, you know, someone at some point has tried it on me before I get to a competition, usually.
That's good.
And if they haven't, like if I feel my opponent is doing something where I'm like, okay, what is this? Then I also know if I don't know what this is, it's probably not good and I should get out of it. It's pretty simple.
That's a
It's
nice
pretty
point of
simple.
view.
I
If I
mean,
haven't seen it, it's not good.
if I haven't seen it before, it's not good. Get the hell out.
That's kind of cool.
So, yeah, that's yeah.
So you told Keenan that when he tried the worm guard?
I haven't talked to him
Okay,
felt his worm guard yet.
he's coming over to you guys soon, I think.
Yeah, actually, he's coming on Friday, but I'll be going to London for our Checkmate Interclub weekend. So, but I'm sure. But I've had a, you know, I've had some of our guys try and do worm guard on me, where I'm like, okay, I know I don't really know what they're doing because I haven't had time to sit down and watch either worm guard instructionals or how to pass it. But as I said, I know if I let them control the grip on the lapel, wrap it around my leg, start controlling my leg, then already there I've had at least three or four opportunities to not let them do that. So that's what I work on.
Okay, cool. So is it like important for you to have like a big team behind you, and what kind of benefits do you see like having such a big team as Checkmate behind you?
Yeah, I do actually. I totally respect the smaller independent gyms. For me, a big team gives you two things. Firstly, if you are competing at a high level, I believe you need a good, strong, big team behind you, because at least for the trainings up to the big competitions, Europeans, Worlds, whatever, especially Worlds, you need to have a lot of, you know, world-class athletes to help you train up, to help you get good. And you're just not going to get that in a small academy. So you need to be able to go somewhere where you will have people, you know, the best from each academy together to train at that level. So that's, you know, that's the competition level of it, is I feel you need to have that that team and that structure behind you.
Yeah.
If you're not a competitor, I believe from what I've seen and from what I've felt that even for your jiu-jitsu, and especially if you are, especially in Europe, there's not now, but, you know, when Brazilian jiu-jitsu started in Denmark and also, you know, other places in Europe with no, you know, established black belt, I feel you need some kind of structure, and you need elements in your teaching and in the concepts you teach in jiu-jitsu and the way you teach things that resemble each other.
Okay.
So I felt that for us it made a huge difference that we were under Checkmat, because even if it wasn't Leo that came and taught, it doesn't matter if it was Leo, if it was Hiko, if it was one of, you know, some of their really good students, they all had the same kind of concepts, the same kind of way of working the positions, the slightly different details, but not too different, the same kind way of moving, you know, the same movement in passing, the same movement from the bottom. And I think when you're still building your base, that if you have that where you can see elements that no matter who teaches you, some of the basic elements and the basic concepts are the same,
yeah,
I think it's going to be easier for you to learn that, to learn the basics and learn the concepts. Because in the like now, if someone comes and teaches me like a whole nother way that I haven't seen of passing the guard or something like that, then, you know, I can relate it to what I already know, and I can better like discern whether this fits into my game or it doesn't, or how to fit it into my game, because I have one base, then I can slowly change that. But I feel, and what I've seen when I've, you know, trained with other people from smaller gyms without affiliation and things, if you kind of just like take a little bit from everywhere, you end up only taking like specific techniques and maybe not taking the concept. It's kind of hard to explain because it's kind of abstract.
But I think I know where you're going.
So you don't get that, like, you don't get that connected big picture as your base jiu-jitsu. You get all these fragmented pieces that no one put together for you.
Okay.
Because one came and taught you one way, another taught the other way. No one showed the big picture. No one showed the connection between things.
You just get the dots. You don't get the lines.
Exactly. You get the dots.
Yeah.
You don't get the lines. So you don't connect things in the same way. So for me, I feel that's another thing that a big team will be able to give you, is always give you dots and the lines.
Yeah.
Also because there is just a difference whether, you know, there'll always be a difference if you have someone come give a seminar at your academy, if they have a real interest in developing you and your gym, or if they're just coming to show some nice things and then move on. Because if they are, you know, if at some point your students are going to be fighting their students,
yeah,
they'll show you the dots, and there's nothing secret about jiu-jitsu. You know, all the techniques, everything is there. But the lines, as you say, how to connect the dots, they won't explain that in the same way. I guarantee you 99% of people won't take the time, won't explain that in the same way as they would for their own students. Especially also because, you know, a seminar for 2 hours is just a seminar for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And explaining the lines may take a little longer. So, I feel that everyone needs to have some kind of, doesn't have to be as big as Checkmat or Alliance or Gracie Baja. There are other organizations out there, but you need some kind of a network of people who will, you know, within the same structure will always be helping, I think, to develop well.
Did you always like appreciate the team building stuff, or is it just something that you appreciate as you go up in the grades?
No, I always did, because I started competing at Worlds already at Blue Belt.
Okay, yeah.
So I've always needed that structure. I've always needed that backup. It's always made a huge difference to my game, even when I just maybe had 1 week extra of training in Brazil before a competition, or in LA before the Worlds or something. That's always made a big difference to me. So I've always appreciated the network and the structure and the support from the team.
Okay. So do you think you're gonna have time and like energy enough to compete at the tournaments this year to get the points for the Worlds?
I have enough points for Worlds next year
Okay,
already,
cool.
so I
Okay.
don't need to run right now. I think I'm ranked, oh, I think I'm ranked 17th or something.
Yeah, okay.
And have lots of points for next year. So my main goal to compete this year, I hopefully I'll be competing in London Open next month, and then I will hopefully do one of the Abu Dhabi trials. So my goal for competing this year is, firstly, I want to make sure that I've developed and changed some things in my game since Worlds, so I need to test that out. I always think it's good to test things out before a big competition.
Yeah.
So I need to test that out before Europeans. That's one thing that's important for me. And I'm the kind of person, I need to compete regularly if I'm to perform well. You know, if it's been like 6, 7 months since I competed last, I stand there before I fight and I'm like, what am I doing here? I don't know how this is supposed to feel. Oh, this whole fighting thing, how does that really work? You know, the mental part. Oh, so I need to be doing it regularly at the small competitions to feel comfortable
Okay.
and to do well at the big ones. So, yeah.
So what is your opinion about the black belt points for the Worlds? Is it something that is good or is it something that you don't like?
I think it's okay, actually.
Yeah.
I would change a little bit the system that they have for it, the way they do it. I think it should be either points or in some way like qualifying by being on the podium at some of the big competitions. For example, it's okay that they have it's good that they have that if you've won Worlds before, you can always, you know, sign up for Worlds again.
Yeah.
But I also think points enough or not, even if you got third place at one of the big competitions, I mean, if you made it to the podium, even if you fought nothing else, if you made it to the podium, especially in men adult, you know, black belt at Europeans, a Pans, a Brasileiro, or Worlds,
Yeah.
even if it's third place, that should automatically qualify you for next year's Worlds.
Even though that I don't know how often that happens, but sometimes you have like you are the only competitor.
Yeah, but you're never the only competitor at the big competition. That's why I'm saying
Yeah, okay.
if you get third place at London Open, no, that doesn't mean you get to fight Worlds next year.
Okay.
But if you are on, you know, on the podium at Worlds or at Europeans, then that should qualify you for next year's Worlds,
Okay.
I think.
Yeah.
So there's a few. I like the idea of it, but there's I think they need to make a few adjustments in terms of, yeah, how to deal with, like. In terms of the points and how many points you get for what, and you know, qualifying in terms of podium. I also see that actually in Europe we have a lot more competitions than in Brazil. So it's a lot easier for European black belts to get the points
Okay.
because there's fewer black belts and pretty much almost more competitions than there are there. And I also understand people's criticism about that the IBJJF competitions are pretty expensive in terms of what you get out of it.
Yeah, that was my next
So
question because it for many people that like you are both working and training BDJ with not any like financial backup, it could cost a lot of money to travel and to gather these points.
It does. It does. And you know, and we have other competitions that are really good now too, you know. Like Swedish Open things. It's not an IBJJF competition, but it's one of the best competitions around.
Yeah.
So I also understand that people would rather spend half the fee that you do on IBJJF, would rather spend half of that to compete at Swedish Open. Then, you know, go to one of the IBJJF competitions that sometimes aren't that big yet,
Yeah.
because it is a lot of money.
Do you think there will be like more prize money in competitions? You think that's gonna happen?
I don't know. You see it It's coming. I see it slowly in Brazil. They have
Okay.
more and more competitions. I can see on Facebook, on posters that people put up and stuff, that there's slowly more and more competitions with a little bit of prize money. And in this world, every little bit helps.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know, because there'll never be prize money with IBJJF. It's not going to happen. I don't see it. Not in any foreseeable future.
Why is that?
Because they'll keep the
They want it all to themselves.
money. Of course, I know it. They spend a lot of money on running the smaller competitions. I don't think they make that much money off it. But there's no doubt that the big ones with 3,000 to 4,000 participants, I'm sure that something comes out
But
on
they
the
could
other side.
like make prize money only for the black belt competitors.
Yeah, I think they should do that for the
Yeah.
big competitions, definitely. They try to do that with the pro league thing, but the amount of money is still nothing compared to what people get, for fighting and winning Abu Dhabi World Pro,
Yeah,
which I think
exactly.
is a competition that is actually gaining in terms of prestige and level in it's gaining in on worlds.
Yeah.
You can actually see the last few years that the level at Abu Dhabi Pro, like Pan Ams, has lost out a lot to it.
Yeah.
If you look at especially at black belt competitor list for Pan Ams, used to be one of the big ones. Now at black belt, people would rather save their energy and get prepared for Abu Dhabi instead. So let's see it all. I think it's going to be interesting to see what the Abu Dhabi organization is going to do in the next couple of years,
Yeah. Do
because
you think like
that's
the
going to affect a lot of things too.
Yeah, sure. And also like the rules. I think the rules will somehow decide which tournaments will be popular. Do you think that it some kind of made an effect, these new rules that IBJJF made?
What do you mean, the new
Like with
rules?
the double guard pulls, 15 second rule, I think it is, or the
Yeah, but it's small things.
yeah.
Small things,
But do you see like Abu Dhabi or IBJJF like branching out in other directions and starting like other rules to like make it more exciting, to make it more like strategic or whatever?
Until now, Abu Dhabi and IBJJF have followed the same rules.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think they will. I think, of course, the rules will always be changing, hopefully for the better. But I think for now that they won't try to change the rules independently of each other. I think they'll still. So IBJJF will change, and I think Abu Dhabi will follow for now.
Okay.
I don't think any organization is going to get overnight success by making up a whole new rule set.
No, I don't mean
It,
like making up a whole rule set. I just what would happen if you ban the double guard pool? If one organization like did this, would it be like would they like to be more competitors in that kind of rules, or would it be like less competitors?
I think no, I think everything, I think the other things still decide, like whether it's an IBJJF tournament or not, whether there's
Okay.
money, whether it's well organized. I think that is going to still decide a lot more about which competitions are popular
Yeah.
than small
Okay.
changes in the rules.
Is there any like rule changes you would like to see happening?
I mean, now it's only been at Worlds that there was the double guard pull thing, and I think it was used inconsistently. Sometimes people got penalized quickly, sometimes they didn't. I still think there is. Actually, I think what is more important now is actually still to have referees that understand and are well educated in the rules and are able to apply them consistently and at the same level. I think that's more important than changing the rules all the time.
Okay,
Because
yeah.
if the rules are actually applied correctly and you give the right penalties for double guard pull, for stalling, for things like that, I think a lot of the rules work pretty well. Of course, there are small, kinks and chips that could be smoothed out. But the problem is every time you change the rules, you also introduce a new element of uncertainty for both the competitors competitors and the referees. And right now, I think it would be better with a period with, you know, stability and make sure to have good, well-educated, consistent referees than to just keep changing the rules. If people can't apply them anyway, then it doesn't matter what the hell you write. I mean, you can change everything you want, but if the referees don't do it, don't get it or don't apply it consistently, then it doesn't matter.
Since you're both a competitor and a referee, how frustrating is it for you if you can see the referee making mistakes in your fights?
It sucks. I think for me, but you also get a whole nother understanding of it when you do referee.
Yeah.
Everyone makes mistakes. Referees make mistakes. Competitors make mistakes. Coaches, everyone, you know, we're just human. We make mistakes. What pisses me off is not mistakes that are made, what can you say, by accident. But I really get annoyed and pissed off if I can tell that, like, a referee, if I also know a lot of the referees by now, so I, you know, I know who has the rules down, who gets it and who doesn't. But I think one of the worst things is it's really disrespectful when you see referees looking at another match on the mat on the side, because, you know, that's more interesting. And that happens a lot, especially to the lower belts. And that kind of thing, I think that's really disrespectful. That pisses me off a lot. Because, you know, you're there to referee. Someone has put a lot of hours on the mat, a lot of sweat, a lot of hard work to be there to give their best. So if you make an honest mistake as a referee, that'll happen. But if you make a mistake because you weren't watching the fight, then that's really bad.
So what's the hardest, being a referee? Is it being consistent, or is it like to catch up with everything going up, or?
I think there are a few games and a few weight classes that are harder to referee than others.
Such as?
There's no doubt that, you know, small guys, like everything under light, everything under 70 kilos is going to end up in a lot of 50-50 in beating Bolo and spinning around. So keeping track of who's up and who's down, I admit that's that can be a little challenging sometimes. Yeah. White belt fights actually can
really?
Be kind of hard, because they never stop. So you're like they do everything, and I was like, oh, you almost passed the guard. Wait, no, you didn't. You continue. You mounted. No, you didn't mount. Now you rolled off. Now you're on the bottom. So some white belt fights a bit confusing. The small guys spinning around and sometimes also the people who do a lot of stand up, because there's a lot of situations. The mat isn't very big, so a lot of the calls where they land on the edge or they're on the way out, do you give the advantage? Do you not? Can be tricky as well.
Yeah.
That's.
So what do you do to keep up with everything to be a better referee?
I I've attended the IBJJF rules course quite a few times by now. I always read the rules. Every time I know I'm going to referee, I take the rule book with me and I sit and then I read it the night before and I read it at breakfast.
Okay.
So, and I know which parts, which of the small details I have troubles, you know, remembering. It's not that many, but there's always like three or four things like, oh, what was that? So, you know, I have notes written down in my hard copy of the printout of the rules. I pretty much, as if I was going to go to an exam or an important meeting, I read through my notes, make sure that the things that I know I sometimes forget, or the things that aren't that logical, there are parts that you just have to, you know, learn and that aren't just that logical. I always make sure that I look them over before I referee.
Is it fun to be a referee?
Yeah, I think it's fun. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard work as well.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, also, you know, it's also really important. I think another thing that's hard is if the organizers haven't hired enough referees, that's difficult because you can't stand there the whole day without enough breaks. So, you know, ideally the whole like 1 hour refereeing, 1 hour off, I think is best.
Yeah.
if you stand there too long, you start making mistakes. But it's fun. It is.
Do we have enough referees in Scandinavia?
Yeah, I think so. It's sometimes I can see that some of the tournaments it's difficult to get everyone. People don't always maybe have time, and it's important that that we always, you know, have new people wanting to referee, because some people always, you know, drop out, stop, or not have time or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in general, I think that the referee level in Scandinavia is pretty good and works out pretty well most of the competitions.
Yeah. I can see when you're at Swedish Open, you can see like the referees standing there for hours. So.
Swedish Open is actually one of the good ones. I think Martin Jensen always makes sure that we're two referees on each mat. Okay. So if you if you partner up with a buddy and you make sure the problem can be that most referees also are coaches.
Yeah.
So they have people fighting. So, but of course, you just have to make sure that whoever you're refereeing with, that you have very clear agreement on how long you stand there for.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't matter if you have students, you know, fighting. If you're going to be refereeing, you know, you have to stick to whatever you agreed with your buddy, whether it's 45 minutes or an hour or an hour and a half, or whatever it is. Okay. So, yeah.
One thing that I read about you on Facebook with both you and Ida is like you have the girls' camp.
Yeah.
I did the podcast just recently with Clara Tibbling.
Yeah.
And we talked about this girl training. Is it necessary to have girls training, or should it be like combined? What do you think?
I think it's really good to have some girls training. I think if you only have girls only training, I would never say, oh, you should only train with other girls.
Okay.
I think it's really good to have like an introduction group for girls, for new girls, because it's really hard, you know, the whole getting over the physical barrier of like, okay, you're rolling around with sweaty, big, you know, men, and it's really close physical contact. So I think it's good to have girls classes so new women can ease into that part of it. And usually once they're into it and comfortable with it, then it's no problem at all.
Yeah.
But it takes a couple of classes, and it's nice. It's a safer environment if it's only girls than if you kind of like throw them to the wolves in the first class. So that's the one thing where I think it's good to have girls. And of course, you know, it really depends on if you're a competitor or just in general to develop yourself. It depends on who you have of training partners.
Right.
You know, if you have a lot of training partners your own size in the gym, then, and you know, your own weight and kind of your own strength, then it doesn't matter whether it's girls or guys. But usually there is a size difference.
Yeah.
And then it's nice to be able to also have girls. And if you're competing, it's girls sometimes move in another way. Often they're more flexible and stuff. So then it's nice also to have, you know, to try that out as well.
Yeah.
I have really great sparring in the gym, and we also have good girls and stuff. But even then, when I get to competition, sometimes I feel like, oh, you're small and you're bendy and your legs are all over the place. You know?
You're bendy. That's a new word.
You know, and they, you know, the girls, especially the smaller girls at competitions, they do the same thing I do with the guys at my gym.
Yeah, okay.
So it's not 100% necessary, but I think it's good to have some of it.
Yeah.
But again, you also have to make sure that whoever you do have as sparring partners at your gym, that they learn how to, you know, how to spar with the girls. They learn how to roll.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a black belt, yeah, but you know, I'm not made of steel or titanium or anything. So if you go too hard on me, the chance of me getting injured in some way is still higher than it would be if I was a man.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
So what can you tell me about the girls' camp?
Ida and I run a girls' camp. We've done that the last couple of years. It's biannual, so we usually do it every spring and every autumn. And until now, we've just had it in Copenhagen. Now let's see, Ida's moved to Sweden, if we'll move it there once in a while.
Yeah.
And the concept is basically the idea is to get girls from all over Europe to come and train together for a weekend from Friday to Sunday. We have hard training, but we also make sure that there's time for girls to socialize, talk to each other, because that's another important part. A lot of girls, they're social trainers as well. They need to feel that they have that support behind them. They need to feel they can talk to people and stuff like that. So that's what we kind of provide them as well, is inspiration within each other and see, hey, maybe you're completely alone at your gym, but you're not alone in the world. There are others like you. So yeah, we have a really, really, really great time doing these women's camps. And the next one actually is coming up next month from 24th to 26th of October in Copenhagen. And we'll also have Michelle Nicolini coming as a guest teacher. We try and do it so like every spring it's Ida and I pretty much, and every autumn we get someone else. It doesn't have to be Checkmate. It's not a Checkmate camp. It's a women's camp open for everyone
Okay,
of
that's
any
nice.
affiliation. And we try and get some of the other high level women in who we look up to. Like we had Hanechi Stack last year, who's awesome person also. People who we feel have a lot of jujitsu to share, a lot of life experience to share. Try to bring them in as well and give the girls a nice weekend. So yeah,
Sounds awesome.
that's
Is
what
it
we
like
do.
but fr Friday to Sunday?
Friday to Sunday, we always start Friday evening, so pretty much you can, from most places in Europe, you can catch a flight after work. If you get off work a little early on Friday, come train with us the whole weekend, sleep at the gym for free, and we end Sunday afternoon. So we respect that most people have, a normal life on the side, so people can still manage to get home Sunday evening and be ready for work. Maybe a little tired, but they'll be there Monday morning.
So where can you find information about the camp if you want to look into it?
Yeah, we have information on we have a Facebook page. We call the camp, it's called the BJJ Bonanza. So it's the Women's BJJ Bonanza camp. So look that up or look me up on Facebook and I can send the link to the page.
How important do you think it is for the girls to have another girl like a role model?
I think it's really important. I mean, I never rolled with a black belt before. I think it was maybe brown belt or something like that. And I always thought, oh, every time there was just someone who was a little higher belt than me, that was just like, oh my God. So I think it's important to have them. I think it's important to, it's always good. I mean, the whole point of role models is someone you can in some way connect to, you can in some way look up to, and who you can relate to. So it is just different. I mean, Rodolfo Vieira and Bochecha are just not role models for us girls in the same way.
Really?
I mean, it's because we can't relate. We're never going to look like
Hope
that.
not.
No, exactly. And not even how hard we train, it's never going to be that level of explosiveness and things like that. So we need something else we can relate to, which we also think is like just awesome. Like they are, they're really awesome, but. Yeah, I can never strive to be, like Bushesha, but I can strive to be like as aggressive as Michelle, for example, or something like that. So yeah.
That's another thing I talked to Clara about. Is like there are many instructionals with guys,
Yeah.
Bushesha, and but they're not as much instructionals with girls. Why is that?
I think because in a way the girls we still don't we don't have get as much attention as the guys. We don't have as many fans, we don't have as many followers, we don't have people looking up our fights as much as the guys do. We don't get booked as much for seminars. Firstly, because part of it is just we're not that many yet, so we're still the minority in some way. And I think even though, we have some really, really good women who are technically as, I think as good as some of the men, but it looks different because we don't have the same explosion, because we don't have the same power, then people think, oh, they're not quite as good or something, but we just do it in a different way. And in that way, BJJ still has kind of an old school mentality where the best coach has to be able to beat people up. If you look at football, the football coach is like an old guy in a suit who hasn't been on the field for the last 20 years probably. But that's not where at BJJ yet. BJJ, people still want a coach who can not just tell them what to do and show them, but who can prove it to them.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I'm not sure.
So what will it take to get like more women into like releasing instructionals to like show other girls their techniques besides doing seminars?
Well, I mean, to do an instructional, you need someone to come up to you, or you know, you need also to have the resources to have a decent camera person, time to put it together. You know, people willing to pay for it or willing to see it and you know generate some kind of market value for it. Yeah. You know, so there has to be a wish and a market for it.
Yeah, but you can do it the old school way, release DVDs, but you know, you see many people having like their own websites, Keenan,
yeah.
Mendes, Galau,
yeah.
And Marcelo, everyone has
yeah.
their own like
has their own.
Website where they can
yeah.
subscribe for a decent amount and get the techniques. And
exactly, can... yeah. But I think DVDs are pretty much on the way out. I mean,
yeah.
Who's going to order a DVD? You know, you stream everything.
Yeah, who has a DVD player?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so your the sites are aimed for Swedish Open, Europeans.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Swedish Open yet if I'll actually fight it, because we're not that many girls in Scandinavia. Brown and black are still together, and I feel some of the brown belts now we have more who want to fight. Before I fought pretty much just with Ida, just to show that there were people around.
Yeah.
But I want to referee and coach as well, Swedish Open, and I have referee, coached, and fought, but it gets kind of a lot to do.
Yeah.
So as I said before, my goal is mostly London Open, and then probably one of the trials for Abu Dhabi, because I want to qualify again. I want to go to Abu Dhabi next year again.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So you're gonna start training practice soon.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry, you're gonna start competition practice soon, to like to amp up your game.
I've already started.
Yeah, I've already started. Okay. So that's why
yeah.
I'm so tired. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you to see you in Stenungsund. I think of going to the Swedish Open. I think it's a good tournament. You always
yes,
play.
I will definitely be there.
Yeah.
So.
Is there anything you would like to say thanks to, or like a shout out or anything?
Yeah, well, I would like to say, as always, thank you to my coaches, Shimon. At the academy, and also thanks to Leo Vieira, who's like my other coach when I travel to the States. Thanks to my training partners at the gym, and of course, thank you, a big, huge thanks to my sponsors who helped me out. And that's Shoei Rolls for the geese and all my gear. And I have a biohack.dk for some of my supplements, and a clothes shop called selecteddesign.dk as well.
Okay.
So big thanks to them.
Can I ask you how you landed the Shoei Roll sponsorship? Because I can see so many competitors just in awe wondering, how did she manage that?
Well, I know Bear, who owns Shoei Roll. I know Bear through Checkmat and through Leo.
Okay.
Of course, they get a lot of you know people in who want to be sponsored. I know that I haven't, you know, won worlds at black belt, but I've had consistent results since I started competing. There's only 1 year since 2007 where I competed and didn't get on the podium, and then 1 year where I missed it. So I've been consistently on the podium at pretty much everything. So it wasn't just the personal relation that the you know, that I knew who he was. It's not that he was a good friend or anything. It wasn't just that. It's I landed it because of my results. I landed it because they think I have a good story in terms of I have good results even though I don't do this full time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I put a lot of work into this. I put a lot of work into through refereeing, through girls' camps, through other things, also to try and build BJJ up, to build the sport up.
Yeah.
So that's what I know. I had a chat with him about it, and that's what they told me. That's
yeah.
why I got the sponsorship, because
yeah.
they thought I was a good profile and had good results.
It's awesome. It's they have such nice geese.
Yeah, they do. It's and it's a great fit for girls. It's the best fit I've had. until now for women. So
cool. So if the girls out there listening to this podcast, and I hope that it will, they can look you up on Facebook to get
getting
in touch with you regarding the girls camp, or
yes,
if they just
course.
Want to train with you in some other
yes.
way.
Yes, always just get in touch on Facebook.
Cool.
Shanti Abelia, and follow me on Instagram, ShantiBJJ. Put up some training videos sometimes.
Cool.
Put up usually my strength and conditioning stuff. Was what I put up little videos of on Instagram and things like that. So
you can see more and more BJJ players coming into the social media. Is that a thing you think that people need to do to get their name, a household name?
I think it's hard to do and it takes time, but I think it definitely helps. You can see some people who, you know, who are really good at profiling themselves on social media, like Kit Dale.
Yeah.
You know, he has good, solid jiu-jitsu, but he's also been really good at capitalizing on the publicity, capitalizing on that part of it as well, you know.
Yeah.
Another one who's also really good at doing it, controversial or not, is Gabby Garcia. You know, I actually looked today. She has like 54,000 followers on Instagram. That's a lot.
How many of them do you think are into BJJ?
I don't know, but probably not all. So there's a lot. She has a lot of non-BJJ followers, and if you want the sport to grow, and if you want to be able to get, you know, sponsorships, you know, you have to be able to have a profile that's not just BJJ.
Yeah.
Because that's just too narrow right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is.
So is it possible for you to be able to face her in some competition? It's like in open class or something?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, of course it's possible.
How do you feel about that?
I feel fine.
Yeah?
I feel fine about it. I would fight her, of course, if the draw came up and I had to fight her, I would fight her. Unless if I was already injured or something, you know, then I wouldn't. And how much resistance I would do really would depend on, especially for black belts, we have the open class before the weight class.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really would depend how early, in what early stage. If it was like the first fight and I was nowhere near the podium for the open class, then I probably wouldn't try as hard, wouldn't risk anything at all, because you know it could affect my performance in the weight class. But I would fight her.
Have you seen her in real life?
Yeah, loads of times. I've talked to her.
Is she that huge that she looks like?
Yes.
Yes.
she's big. Yeah. She's lost a lot of weight. So she's really, you know, she's in really great shape and cut right now. But no matter how much weight she loses, she's still really tall.
Yeah.
You know, she's a tall woman and, you know,
she's
built. She's built big. So no matter what, you know, when she stands next to Bushesha, when she stands next to Alexander Trance, she's still big.
That must be so terrifying.
So, you know, that's just how she's built. That's nothing, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's another subject.
Yeah.
So I would wish you all the best of luck in upcoming competitions.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on this podcast. It was fun to do.
Yeah,
I don't know how it's going to sound afterwards, but it was
gonna
really fun.
It's going to sound awesome. But it's nice to get a nice little view of you, who you are and your background and what your opinions are. And in that way, we also kind of like spread the BJJ around Scandinavia mostly, of course.
Yeah.
But people get a little bit a portion of who you are. Most people perhaps see you on the mats competing or having you as a referee. They don't like can spend an hour talking to you about your background.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's kind of
that's
cool.
True. Yeah. So thank you for doing this and supporting the community this way.
Thank you for taking time to participate.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Take care, and I hope to see you in Stenungsund.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Thank you to Top Rank Equipment. Thank you to Defense Soap. Please check it back again. And please go in on the Facebook page on the Matt BJ podcast. like it and share it. Okay, guys, take care. Bye.